Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the Electronic Charles.
How does Bellevue Hill look today? Is it foggy, misty?
Yeah, a little bit of gloom there, I think. You know, yes, it's not its normal, vibrant presence in my
imposing
life.
Self.
Yes,
we had a little spring, and now we're lurching back into late winter again.
Paleo winter.
Exactly. What are you having for breakfast this spring morning, Professor McConville?
I am still trying to stay off the carbs, although I know it's not going to last long. I am having 3 strips of bacon, some grapes,
Of course,
a few pieces of Havarti cheese, little ones, and a tiny bowl of granola.
I see. So the cheese, do you have the small pieces of cheese because you somehow that makes the cheese last longer, or what's the reason?
Well,
here?
I mean, that's a lot of, you know, in other words, there's quite a bit of animal there, and I want to limit my animal consumption.
I get it. Well, listen, we can't launch into our next arc or next episode without looking back for a minute and saying we did 7 episodes on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And I have to say I learned a lot over those 7 episodes. And I think we did our bit in bringing people down. And yeah. it's a very, very troubling subject, but the 7th episode gave us some hope.
Yeah, and we're going to pick up on that in the news this week.
Oh, good.
We're going to talk a little bit about several things. We are at the anniversary of the partition, the 100-year anniversary of the partition of Ireland.
Great. Well, that is a perfect segue into what I have for you today as a surprise. Oh. I had intended to use this in the last episode, but it's because of part 7 was so, we had a lot to get through there, a lot of time to cover.
A huge amount to get through.
Right. So I wanted to read for our audience and for you a passage by G.K. Chesterton, who was an English essay writer, political, religious, social commentator of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. I think he's one of the greatest essay writers of all time. And I've recommended this piece to you many times, but I don't know if you've ever read it or not.
I don't know that I have.
Okay, it's in his book, Heretics. Heretics.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning this to me many times.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book. I've read it many, many times. Came out in 1905, so it's before the partition, okay?
Right.
So this, I think, gives us some perspective. This is an Englishman writing about Ireland in 1905. This essay is called Celts and Celtophiles. And he talks about what makes a nation, all right? What makes a nation? He says, now, of this great spiritual coherence, independent of external circumstances or of race or of any obvious physical thing, Ireland is the most remarkable example. Rome conquered nations, but Ireland has conquered races. The Norman has gone there and become Irish. The Scotchman has gone there and become Irish. The Spaniard has gone there and become Irish. Even the bitter soldier of Cromwell has gone there and become Irish. Ireland, which did not exist even politically, has been stronger than all the races that existed scientifically. The purest Germanic blood, the purest Norman blood, the purest blood of the passionate Scotch patriot has not been so attractive as a nation without a flag. Ireland, unrecognized and oppressed, has easily absorbed races as such trifles are easily absorbed. She has easily disposed of physical science as such superstitions are easily disposed of. Nationality in its weakness has been stronger than ethnology in its strength. 5 triumphant races have been absorbed and have been defeated by a defeated nationality. This being the true and strange glory of Ireland, it is impossible to hear without impatience of the attempts so constantly made among her modern sympathizers to talk about Celts and Celticism. Who were the Celts? I defy anybody to say. Who are the Irish? I defy anyone to be indifferent or to pretend not to know. Mr. W.B. Yeats, the great Irish genius who has appeared in our time, shows his own admirable penetration in discarding altogether the argument from a Celtic race. But he does not wholly escape, and his followers hardly ever escape, the general objection to the Celtic argument. The tendency of that argument is to represent the Irish or the Celts as a strange and separate race, as a tribe of eccentrics in the modern world immersed in dim legends and fruitless dreams. Its tendency is to exhibit the Irish as odd because they see the fairies. Its trend is to make the Irish seem weird and wild because they sing old songs and join in strange dances. But this is quite an error. Indeed, it is the opposite of the truth. It is the English who are odd because they do not see the fairies. It is the inhabitants of Kensington who are weird and wild because they do not sing old songs and join in strange dances. In all this, the Irish are not in the least strange and separate, are not in the least Celtic, as the word is commonly and popularly used. In all this, the Irish are simply an ordinary, sensible nation, living the life of any other ordinary and sensible nation which has not been either sodden with smoke or oppressed by moneylenders or otherwise corrupted with wealth and science. There is nothing Celtic about having legends. It is merely human. The Germans, who are, I suppose, Teutonic, have hundreds of legends, wherever it happens that the Germans are human. There is nothing Celtic about loving poetry. The English love poetry more, perhaps, than any other people before they came under the shadow of the chimney pot and the shadow of the chimney pot hat. It is not Ireland which is mad and mystic. It is Manchester which is mad and mystic, which is incredible, which is a wild exception among human things. Ireland has no need to play the silly game of the science of races. Ireland has no need to pretend to be a tribe of visionaries apart. In the matter of visions, Ireland is more than a nation. It is a model nation.
Awesome passage, man.
Isn't that amazing?
Incredible passage. Yeah, it sure is.
Unbelievable. Written by an Englishman, you know, before this terrible time of the separation that led to these time of troubles we described. I just love that passage. Makes me think of you.
It's very hard. Another great admirer, incidentally, of Ireland, and in some respects an Anglo-Irishman himself, Edmund Burke, who was a firm advocate for Catholic emancipation in the 18th century, and a deeper understanding of the Irish people. He urged that in British government. He urged it to his friends intellectually. And of course, many people sort of laughed at him, you know, sort of ignored that part of it. But he had very similar, in some respects, respect for the Irish people.
An English novelist, Anthony Trollope, one of my all-time favorites, tried to make his career writing about Ireland. He had been, he was a postal official in Ireland, and he wanted to write about Ireland. That was his great passion, and he wrote several of his early novels set in Ireland, and his publisher said, you know, you got to stop this. We can't sell these books. You got to write about England. So what did he do? He wrote the Palliser series, which is about English politics, and two of those books are about an Irish politician. Phineas Finn and Phineas Redux. So he gets his Irish in, you know.
It's amazing how many 18th century historians try to anglicize Burke, because Burke sees himself as being a kind of product of Ireland in some respects. Mm-hmm. And that people want, in some scholars, not all, but some try to ignore that because it's the same process in a sense, you know?
Yeah. Well, what I love about that essay of Chesterton, one of the things I love about it is he explodes the whole idea of a nation, you know, the flag, the borders, you know, all these things. Right. There's something else going on.
Of course. And
there's something else going on in Ireland. That thing, Northern Ireland, is there's something, you know, there's something unnatural about it, you know, and the fact that it's continuing to generate problems is understandable.
I also think that one of the things that gets forgotten, and as we mentioned that several times during the course of our arc there on Northern Ireland, is even somebody like Ian Paisley would say, I'm an Ulsterman. I'm an Irishman.
Exactly.
Even though they wanted to remain loyal to the British crown, at least, that he recognized, I'm Irish. And that's one of the reasons why he was able to reach accommodation with Martin McGuinness, because he realized McGuinness is Irish. He's not these London authorities. He's London bureaucrats.
Yeah. And Chesterton saw that before all those problems even arose. He could see that. Well, we're going to take a leap far back in time today. And we're going to start a series of episodes on what we're calling pre-classical Greece. You know, everybody knows about the Athens of Pericles and Socrates and all these guys. We're sick of them. Come on, enough with those guys. Let's talk about the really early Greek history. Greek history before the Greeks everybody thinks they know about. And I don't think we'll just go one after the other. We'll do other shows, intersperse other things, but we're going to start an arc anyway. And so I thought we would start today with the question, who are the Greeks? Who are they and where did they come from? And this is a very controversial question, and it has to do with a larger question, which is the origin of Indo-European languages in the European continent and, of course, the Indian subcontinent. That's why Indo-European languages are called Indo-European, because they're spoken in India and they're spoken in Europe. There's been a lot of scholarship in the last 30 years on this question, which has really upset the standard view, pretty much the standard view up until 30 or 40 years ago was one of two things. There was either the view that these Indo-European people speaking these languages came probably out of Asia Minor or somewhere north of the Black Sea and moved into Europe around 7,000 or 6,000 BC, and they brought with them agriculture. This was the view of Colin Renfrew, very famous ancient historian. And Renfrew pretty much held the field. People thought, yeah, around 6,000 BC or so, these guys who had this technology, they could actually grow their own food. You know, they show up in the European continent. And they bring this family of languages with them, or this proto-Indo-European, early Indo-European. But then there was another view that maybe later around 4,000 BC, they moved in using horses, that it was horsemanship that was the technology that made them able to, you know, push into Europe. And this was a theory of a scholar named Maria Gimbutas, sometimes called the Kurgan theory, because it's associated with these big horse burials, Kurgan burials north of the Black Sea.
Kurgan burial mounds.
Right, where these big mounds, exactly, which Herodotus describes in his history.
And they actually buried whole horses in them, exactly, as I recall.
Exactly. And Herodotus describes this, and he puts it in the right spot. And that view has been reasserted in the last few years by a scholar named David Anthony, who wrote a book called The Horse and the Wheel. And Anthony tries to establish that, indeed, it was these horse riding steppe dwellers from north of the Black Sea who moved into Europe. They moved west into Europe and east into eventually the Indian subcontinent around 3000 BC or so. But I don't hold with either of those theories.
Naturally.
I follow the views of a scholar named Robert Drews, who's now retired, taught at Vanderbilt for years. And actually, he was the teacher of my teacher at Baylor, Randy Todd. And Drews wrote a book called The Coming of the Greeks, which came out in 1988. It is a superb book. It's almost like a mystery novel. It's so well written, well documented. Anyway, Drews's hypothesis is that the proto-Indo-European speakers don't show up in the Balkans until about 1800 or 1700 BC at the earliest. And they show up with the technology of chariots. It's chariots that make this invasion successful. Yeah. Drew's book certainly made an impression. And then there was pushback from David Anthony and these people who are still pushing the horse theory. You know, it's not chariots, it's just the riding of horses. And Drew's published another book about 10 years ago with the unfortunate title, Militarism and the Indo-Europeanizing of Europe, in which he takes on Anthony head on. And tries to show that, in fact, and I think he does show, that horse riding played no military role in this period before about 1800 or 1700 BC. It was the chariot that made the horse militarily important, and we'll come back and talk about that.
We're coming up on our first break. We'll be right back with the historians.
Cedars Foods believes Mediterranean food should be made just as they are in the tiny villages that made them famous, with simple, fresh, whole ingredients. Cedars hummus, tzatziki, and other delicious Mediterranean food products can be found in grocery stores throughout New England and across the United States. Head to their website, www.cedarsfoods.com, for a coupon and to learn more about Cedars Store.
Demoulas Supermarkets, under the trade name Market Basket, is a chain of 80 supermarkets in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Maine. Demoulas Supermarkets, Market Basket, more for your dollar.
Spring is here with warmer weather, baseball, and road trips. And Sullivan Tire and Auto Service is here, too, with big league savings. Now offering an exclusive buy three, get one free sale on Yokohama tires. Or buy one and get the second at 50% off. Even more ways to save with mail-in rebates on select Yokohama tires. And when it comes to auto maintenance, we do it all, from oil changes to computer diagnostics. Get ready for road trips with our vehicle health report performed by one of our certified technicians. See SullivanTire.com.
We're always here to get you there.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're doing our first in a series of episodes on pre-classical Greece, and we're talking right now about the origins of the Greeks. When did they show up in Greece? Who was there beforehand? Did they even know they were in Greece? Of course not. Nobody was calling that place Greece. So this guy, Robert Drews, in this more recent book, Militarism and the Indo-Europeanizing.
Can I stop you there for one second? Do you think that any of these migrants just thought, let's go to some place which is sunny and warm and pleasant?
Right. Well, there's no doubt. But in Drews's argument in this newer book, which he takes the origin of the Greeks question and really spreads it out to talk about the whole of Indo-European Indo-European languages in Europe as a whole. Basically, he says around 1600 BC, these people who spoke what linguists call Proto-Indo-European, which just means the language from which other Indo-European languages descend, and that includes Greek, all the Latinic languages like Latin, all the Germanic languages like German and Anglo-Saxon and English, all the Celtic languages. All these languages come from a parent language, okay, Proto-Indo-European. And Drew says these guys pushed into the Balkans, into Greece, they pushed into Italy, and they pushed into the area around the Baltic. The Baltic states, what would become the Baltic states, and provide and become the fount from which the Greek language comes, the Latinic languages comes, and the Germanic languages come. But they come with these chariots. Yeah. Drews's point about horse riding is that guys like David Anthony and Gambutus have a grandiose vision of what you could do on a horse before about 1000 BC. And they think people are riding around fighting from horses. But it doesn't seem that a firm seat on a horse was established for a long time after horses were domesticated. Horses were domesticated essentially as food. So the earliest domestic horses, the earliest horses we see on the steppes, they're being used as food animals. A horse actually can get through snow to feed itself in a way that a cow can't.
Right. It paws off and it gets down to the grass.
Right. So it's more able to deal with cold weather than cattle are. And it's a perfectly edible food item, although I have never eaten a horse. I will tell you this.
Me either.
Okay. Drews just says the evidence for horse riding in a military context is absent because there's no, the bit, okay, hasn't developed yet. And the bit, of course, is what allows you to control a horse. David Anthony disagrees. He says, oh, no, they had rope bits, and you can look at the teeth on these horses and see that they've been worn, you know, by these rope bits. But the response to that is, how well can you control a horse with a rope bit? If you don't have a firm seat on the horse, what can you do from it, et cetera, et cetera. The best argument against or in favor of Drews' hypothesis that chariots are the main factor here is that as soon as cavalry riding becomes effective, chariots are left to the side. That is, a guy on a horse who can control his horse actually is more mobile than a chariot is. Right, he can make sharper turns. He can move quicker left and right. He can do things that a chariot can't do.
Varied terrain, which was always the weakness of the chariots. They could not go into varied terrain.
That's an excellent point, too. Yeah, the varied terrain. So if we accept Drews's hypothesis that the Greeks show up around, or the Proto-Indo-Europeans show up in the Balkans around 1600 BC, 1700 BC, there was already a population there. They didn't show up in mass. They showed up in a small number, maybe no more than hundreds, but probably thousands, with their chariots and their composite bows. And the composite bow is the other side of the story. What makes the chariot so devastating as a weapon is not the chariot itself. You can't actually hurt anybody with a 30-pound light war chariot. They're light. They're like tennis rackets, basically. You think of old wooden tennis rackets. What makes the chariot effective is the guy in it who's shooting a composite bow, which was probably the most deadly weapon invented by human beings until the rifle, because it could deliver a metal-piercing projectile 200 yards away in mass numbers, which, of course, even a rifle couldn't do until, the magazine was invented that could hold several rounds.
The killing range of a musket in most of the 18th century, right up until the time of the American Revolution, sort of right before that, you could hit people from further away, but to assure a kill, you had to be within 40 or 50 yards. You had to close with your enemy.
It's amazing. That's a fair debate about whether, you know, Napoleon's army could have withstood an army armed with composite bows, which could deliver. So, because an arrow can be shot over and over and over. If you've got enough arrows, you can just keep shooting them, right? You don't have to stop and reload your freaking musket. Well, these guys, the chariot driving, bronze using Proto-Indo-Europeans, seem to have conquered Greece in short order. And they, as is often the case, a superior technology brings with it language. And that language catches on, the language of the ruling class, the elite.
Who were the people they overran?
We don't know. The Greeks themselves believed that the Greeks called these people Pelasgians. They called the original inhabitants of Greece Pelasgians, and they knew that there were people that lived there before the Greeks. One of the interesting things about the ancient Greeks is they all had their own stories about coming from somewhere else. It was really only the Athenians that claimed to be native to the country. And interestingly, other Greeks, and occasionally the Athenians themselves said, well, yeah, okay, you were native to the country, but you weren't Greek. You were Pelasgians. So this debate about who the Greeks were was going on among the Greeks themselves, say, in the 5th century BC.
I wonder if that could be determined genetically.
They're doing these studies now and have been for a while. But as you can imagine, this has become an extremely controversial subject. And it's been politicized
naturally.
Right. So, for example, what do you do about taking genetic material from a population? Do you just take material randomly from a bunch of graves? Or do you specify, well, here's a rich grave. Are these people in these rich graves a different people than the people that are in the poor graves, right? Or do you treat the whole society as one? You see how this can get very...
Or are the men different from the women, which is another question.
Yep. So it's an extremely touchy subject right now.
Yeah, I bet.
We know that the people who were in Greece before the Greek speakers showed up, the Proto-Indo-Europeans showed up, we know something about their language because some of the words, some of the locations were retained. Like words that have this double S, like Corinthos, Knossos, the city Knossos in Crete, or have the NTH sound, like Corinthos, Corinth. Right. Those appear to be pre-Greek words that were retained by the Greeks after they showed up. So we know some things about the language, but we don't know who they were. But it's interesting that the Greeks knew that there had been another population there, and that they believed they had come from other places. So they thought they had come from Egypt, they had come from Asia Minor, they had come from the north somewhere, right? They told these stories about themselves. But these guys, the interesting thing about the Mycenaeans is that as soon as they show up, they have a very advanced technology. You know, they have gold. They're taking gold from somewhere. There's almost no gold in Greece. So
where would it be coming from? The Balkans or?
Yeah. Well, no, we don't really know. Of course, there was gold in Greece, but it was gold that they themselves had gotten through trade, et cetera. There's only really one place to get gold in Greece, and there are only three places for silver. Very poor in terms of precious metals. But these guys show up, they're wealthy from the get-go, all right? The graves in Mycenae that go back to 1600 BC are already very, very wealthy in terms of gold.
Having seen some of those ruins, you know, pictures and diagrams, it's incredible how elaborate they become so in such a short span of time.
Right. It's just all of a sudden you have guys with this technology, and they have chariots in their art. I mean, they show themselves as chariot drivers. And composite bow wielders. And when we read their texts, which we're able to read, the texts that are written by the Mycenaean Greeks in a script called Linear B is just a form of Greek. It's just written with a different writing system. It's not, it doesn't use the Greek alphabet that we know. It uses a syllabic.
Do you think it was similar in terms of its sound to classical Greek and how it was spoken?
Well, we don't know the answer to that, but of course it's going to sound like a 1,000-year older version. Okay.
Right.
So, but the Greek language has been extremely conservative. This is something that most people, I think, don't appreciate. The English, for example, has changed much more over the last 500 or 600 years than Greek has ever changed over a 500 or 600 year period.
Lack of vowel migration. Things stay pretty steady.
So we can read Linear B now and see words like Eleutherios, Eleftherios, Eleftheria. That means freedom in modern Greek. That word exists in Linear B. Exactly what it means. Does it mean untaxed? You know, seems to, something like that. The same gods' names. Poseidon is there. Zeus is there. They're worshiping the same gods. Now, there's a female Poseidon as well, Poseidoness. There's a female Zeus, Zeus-S.
But there's a continuity. Clearly,
absolutely.
There's continuities.
It's the same religion that the classical Greeks, 1,000 years later, practiced. And they're speaking the same language. So it's amazing. I mean, Greek has a 3,500-year written history that we can trace.
Have they found any other archaeological sites anywhere that are architecturally similar to what the Mycenaeans build?
That's a great question. And the answer to that, in my opinion, is basically no. That you see some sort of vague similarities. But the Mycenaeans seem to have showed up and to have taken their cultural pointers from the Cretans. Okay, Crete was already a very well-developed culture and had palaces and everything for hundreds of years. Crete was probably superior to the Mycenaeans for a while until the Mycenaeans were able to go to Crete and then conquer it. But if you look at Mycenae, for example, in southern Greece, it's pretty clear that they are using the Cretans as their style guide. You know, like if you wanted to build a palace, where do you go to get it decorated? You send for somebody from Crete, you know, who'll do it up for you. And that says something interesting about these Proto-Indo-Europeans, that they seem to have come in with a military technology, but not a firm idea of this is the kind of buildings we build.
That's why I was asking about the architectural.
Yeah. Right.
Now, are the Cretans, do they also speak, they're Greek speaking as well, right?
No, as far as we know, well, we can't answer that question. They wrote with a writing system called Linear A that's never been deciphered. It's similar to Linear B. There are scholars that think it might be related to Greek, but most scholars don't think it is. Most scholars think it's related to other Asiatic languages that were spoken in Asia Minor, probably. So it's a mystery what language the Cretans spoke.
What kind of shipbuilders were the Mycenaeans?
Well, they seem, this is another controversial point. Were they shipbuilders?
At all, right. Were they shipbuilders at all?
So some scholars think they showed up in Greece on boats. Most scholars have thought that they came overland, but the aquatic origin, the marine origin, is gaining ground now. You know, Greece is not particularly well suited to chariots. It's not the place you would choose. You know, driving your chariot from northern Greece to southern Greece is going to be a real pain in the butt.
Very terrain. It's not
exactly
effective for that.
Right. Even if you did it today on the modern roads of Greece, it wouldn't be fun. So to get around by ship and drop off their chariots wherever they needed to and use them, that would make a lot more sense.
Even if you were coasting, in other words, your ship just moved along
the
coast.
That's what most ancient ships did. So we know that the Mycenaeans and the Cretans did ultimately build ships, because we have these frescoes from the island of Thera, for example, Santorini, and Crete, other places that show these ships. They built ships that they rode, you know, and probably could fight for them in terms of with their arrows, et cetera.
With their compound bows.
Yeah, composite bows.
Composite bows, pardon me.
Right.
We are coming up on our second break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Welcome to our neighborhood. Our family has been doing business here since 1914. That's our tradition, and that's why we call ourselves Old Neighborhood Foods. bringing you the finest deli meats for over 100 years. All crafted from our family recipes with the finest ingredients, with no MSG, gluten, or trans fats. That's the old-fashioned way. Old Neighborhood, a family legacy of quality and taste.
Old Neighborhood quality meats and cold cuts, available in the deli cases of all Demoulas Market Baskets and wholesale for restaurants, pizza shops, and delis through Costa's Provisions. Old Neighborhood, Balia Gitonia, a family business owned and operated by the DeMarcus family since 1914.
There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee, available at your local supermarket.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about pre-classical Greece and the Mycenaeans, but before we get back to that story, we have to welcome back one of our earlier historical sponsors, the Public Radio School of Broadcasting. Now, Brenda, do you remember when all those NPR and public broadcasting big shots lost their jobs a few years ago? Garrison Keillor. And
yes, I do. I thought it was entirely appropriate. I have to be.
Well, Garrison Keillor should have been fired for being, you know, terminally annoying.
Yeah, for being Garrison Keillor.
Oh my gosh, horrible. Right. Charlie Rose, Tom Ashbrook. Well, those guys are all still out of work, you know. And that means that there's still prime spots. Prime spots are open for aspiring young radio and TV hosts like us, right? Why haven't they called us? Have you asked yourself this question?
I ask myself it every day.
So there's prime spots open for aspiring young hosts who are dedicated to the idea of publicly funded, socially conscious broadcasting. Maybe that's the thing. We're not committed to publicly funded, socially conscious broadcasting. I don't know.
There's certainly truth to that remark.
Well, if that describes you, listener, you'll want to consider applying to study with our historical sponsor, the Public Radio School of Broadcasting. Founded in Washington, D.C. in 1969 by a mixture of broadcasting veterans, Ivy League journalism professors, and former members of Eugene McCarthy's failed presidential campaign, and funded by a government grant reported to originate with the Department of Defense, and a large donation from both Folgers Coffee and Lazy Boy Recliners, the Public Radio School of Broadcasting graduated its first class of fully qualified public talent in 1973. Many of its early alumni went on to cover major stories like the Watergate hearings, the United States withdrawal from Vietnam, and of course, Germany's victory over Holland in the 1974 World Cup, an event one public radio grad called, quote, the most important sporting event since Uruguay's upset of Brazil in 1950. Not that many Americans will understand why. Well, I certainly don't. Do you understand why?
No. No.
It's an NPR thing. Anyway, since 1973, the Public Radio School of Broadcasting has been churning out graduates who understand the importance and necessary style of public broadcasting. Each degree-earning student must take and pass such courses as vocal emotion eradication, restating the obvious, that's a fun course, restating the obvious, a straw man erection 101, softballs for us, hardballs for them, protecting the system. That sounds like a good course, protecting the system. And of course, advanced demonization. And I think they're even teaching now a super advanced demonization course that I understand is on the way. I find these elective courses they have to be even more interesting. Like this is one you'll recognize, Brendan. Urban good, rural bad. Right? It's a big NPR course. History as enemy. Right? And the apparently wildly popular, the anti-profit motive. Now, as a former economics major, that one really interests me. In the last few years, the Public Radio School of Broadcasting has actively recruited underrepresented groups in public broadcasting, like Catholics and Orthodox Jews. However, despite this aggressive affirmative action campaign, the school has yet to graduate a practicing person of faith. So if you are interested in joining others interested in keeping the public airwaves free of energy and full of the right kind of ideas, visit www.publicbroadcasting.edu or write to Tom or Garrison at lostmygig.org.
Public Radio School of Broadcasting. The public airways are your friend.
And they're so mellow.
Yeah, right. Yeah, those soft, reassuring tones.
Exactly. We don't want to get people excited.
Right? About anything.
Anything. Let's not get them excited. Well, okay. So we've got these Mycenaeans running around in the Balkans with their chariots and their gold and their composite bows. And they eventually conquered Crete and took over the palaces there. You asked me a question during the break. I'm trying to remember now what the
question was. About their relationship to Egypt.
Right. This is a really interesting question. There have been scholars who suggested that the Mycenaeans came from Egypt. That's not a popular view now. The Greeks had a story that they had that some of them had come from Egypt, okay? So the Greeks themselves believed they had some immigration from Egypt. But the interesting thing is that the Egyptians were aware of the Cretan and Greek cultures to their north. And they refer to these people, I believe they called the Cretans the Keftiu, or the people of the islands. And there has been at least one excavation in Egypt of essentially a Mycenaean-style villa built there. The theory is that an Egyptian prince married a Cretan wife, and they built for her a kind of Cretan house with Cretan frescoes and paintings there, so she would feel at home.
Could it be also like an embassy type of thing? Like, you know, in other words?
That's a good theory, too. This is the great thing about this period, Brendan. We don't have enough documents to keep us from having kooky theories.
Right. We can project our emotions, our feelings, everything right on them. It's absolutely ideal.
It's such a great kind of history, you know, and they're not bogged down by documents like you and I are. I mean, this embassy theory, you could get a whole book out of that. You know, the Cretan embassy in the Nile Delta.
But do they find Egyptian artifacts in the islands and in Crete and, you know, in other Mycenaean areas?
Great question. Answer, absolutely yes. Even in Mycenae, those graves that they excavated in Mycenae have Egyptian artifacts in them. The Cretans did. So it's clear that there was interchange between the Mycenaeans and
trade or whatever,
The question that ties to this is whether the Mycenaeans had some kind of political organization. Like, was there a kind of Mycenaean empire?
Okay. A head Mycenaean.
Exactly. Right. Because it's not a silly question if you think about the context. First of all, Homer describes a kind of league of Mycenaeans that attack Troy, right? They're all sort of under Agamemnon.
They recognized him as the key leader.
Yeah.
That's how I would describe that relationship in Homer.
And that's why we refer to these peoples as Mycenaeans. We don't know what they called themselves. We can guess. But we call the culture Mycenaean because Agamemnon was king of Mycenae, and Mycenae is seen as the chief kingdom. They probably called themselves something like Achiawa or Achiawoi, the word that becomes Achaiwoi in later Greek, Achaeans.
The Achaeans,
yeah. And we think that because that's one of the words Homer uses for them, but it's also the word that it seems the Hittites, the culture in Asia Minor, used for them. So the Hittite culture in Asia Minor, which was based on palaces and chariot driving, they had an empire, okay, that ranged from the western coast of Asia Minor all the way to the northern Levant. The Egyptians had an empire that, of course, ran up and down the Nile River and spread up to the southern Levant, where the Hittites and the Egyptians were always running into each other and having battles, like the Battle of Kadesh in around 1275 BC. It's also based on chariot driving. There's a kingdom in Mesopotamia called the Mitanni, and then later the Kassites, who had an empire based on chariot driving. So it's not a silly question to ask what was going on with the Greeks. Did they have this kind of larger imperial sort of structure? And I think that probably most scholars today would say they may have coalesced from time to time under a leader like Agamemnon. But they probably didn't have an ongoing imperial structure.
the geography of Greece and the Greek Isles plays against that to a significant degree.
Yeah, very much. There's an intriguing text. You know, when the Hittite capital at Bogaz Koi, of Hattusas, was discovered in the early 20th century, they found thousands and thousands of tablets of in cuneiform, which have been translated. And there's lots of references to a culture west of the Hittites that they refer to as Achiawa, all right? Achaea, the Achaeans. It's almost certainly the Greeks, okay? And there's one text in which the phrase "the great king of the Achaeawa" is used. And great king was a specific title used for the king of Egypt, the king of the Hittites, okay? Great king of Achaeawa is used, but then it's been scratched out. Like the scribe said, maybe he's not a great king.
A pretty good king.
A pretty good king,
right? Sort of important king.
Yeah, a pretty good king. But those texts refer to raids on the coast of Western Asia Minor by these seafaring peoples, much like the story of the Trojan War, right? Where the Greeks show up and they raid the city of Troy.
And the stories of the sea people.
Exactly. The sea peoples, which will play a very big role in our next episode.
Do we know what they looked like?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because they depicted themselves. In fact, some of the most accurate and naturalistic depictions of human beings and animals before the classical period occur in this period. They were extremely skilled gem makers. They made beautiful little seal stones and gold and seals in which they articulated the human form quite naturally. And in their frescoes and in their art, we can see the kind of clothing they wore. So of course there's debates, you know, about, things like skin tone,
I'm just saying what kind of clothes as they appeared in their everyday life and in their ritual life.
Right. Yes. It seems to be a convention in some ancient art where you get men are portrayed as tan because they're always outside, you know, running around, and the women are fair because they're, you know, kept inside. But one thing we can say about the Cretans, at least, is that they had a fascination with hairstyles. And the Cretan women in these frescoes have these fantastically elaborate hairdos. They must have had a salon on every corner.
What was the basis of their economy or the basis of their, I mean, obviously they're agricultural. That's a big part of it. Were they olive growing or what did they do?
Yeah, they certainly grew olives and cultivated the vine. So we have olive and grapes already going on. The Mycenaeans seem to have had a kind of command and control economy where the palace actually controlled all the hinterland. And so all the material goods that were made, like, textiles and things, and the olive oil and wine seems to have been gathered in centrally and then redistributed to the people. So it doesn't seem like it was anything that would be recognizable to us in terms of a sort of independent freeholding type of society. Right. So it was controlled by the palaces, it seems. But I think their main economic engine was, booty.
That raiding is, other people.
Yeah, raiding other peoples.
Wow.
They
must have had some kind of an ocean-going capability.
Yeah. Oh, certainly they did. We know they did eventually, right? We can see in the frescoes that they have these boats. All right.
Right. Are they single sail boats or are they rowing? Or
they have sails and they have oars. So they don't look very different from the penteconters that were being used, the 50 penteconters of 50, all right, 25 guys on each side. You know, these are basically like Viking longboats,
right?
Except they're lighter, faster, and they're not made to endure the North Atlantic.
Right.
Yeah, if you're making a boat to get around the Aegean, which is a pretty darn calm piece of water in the summertime, that's completely different from trying to navigate in the Baltic or the North Sea.
No, absolutely. Or the North Atlantic. I mean, Iceland and North America.
Yeah, exactly. So between the art, the Linear B texts, we have a pretty good image of what this culture was like. These are Greek speakers. There's a lot of raiding going on. They're building palaces. They're communicating with the peoples of Asia Minor and the Egyptians and the people of Mesopotamia. They're trading with them. There's a whole network of bronze trade, of copper trade that's running all over the Eastern Mediterranean. So you really want to think about them as being part of that Near Eastern world rather than part of Europe. It was a culture that looked to the East, right? Not a culture that looked to the North.
Right. And of course, that makes perfect sense. We are up on our final break. We're going to be right back. We're the historians.
Hi, this is Mike DeStacio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550. And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com.
This is Mike Janity. Join me every Thursday afternoon between 12 noon and 2 o'clock for our Cape Cod Happy Hour Party, featuring all of your favorite party and sing-along songs from the 60s, 70s, and 80s right here on WNTN 1550 AM and WNTN.com.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. For information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com. Brittany, I don't want to leave this subject without saying one more thing about the origin of these Mycenaean early Greeks. The latest scholarship, which is really interpretations of earlier Russian scholarship on the origins of the Proto-Indo-Europeans, tends to place them in the steppes north of the Black Sea and running up to the Ural Mountains and then even to the east of the Ural Mountains, where they have excavated now a culture that's called Sintashta, the Sintashta culture, which flourished between about 2200 and 1800 BC. And it seems to be the area in which bronze metallurgy, copper metallurgy making bronze, and the chariot seems to have possibly originated there. And bronze working didn't originate there, but this was a culture completely focused on the making of bronze.
Wow.
And those two things, the bronze and the chariots, when they met the composite bow, when those three things came together, it was a perfect storm. And it allowed, it seems, small numbers of these people to spread out and conquer very large territories.
Naturally, if you can hit somebody from several hundred yards away,
yep,
and kill them.
Yeah, and get away.
And get away, and not only that, but firepower. In other words, maybe get off 10 shots in a minute.
Yep. Well, if you just imagine what it would be like if you were a people armed only with spears you could throw and a simple bow, a self bow that shoots maybe 40 or 50 yards and not very powerfully, and you run up on 200 guys who have these composite bows and chariots and the devastating. Robert Drews in his book says that this was the origin of real militarism. He doesn't think that things, that battles in the sense that we think of them today, existed before this period. He thinks that most early warfare was carried out by sieges. You got your army together, you went to a city, and you besieged it. And you
Homer.
Yeah, right. And you either took it or you didn't. But that the chariot and the composite bow brought real militarism to the fore. So interesting theory. And we'll talk more about it when we talk about the collapse of this culture next time.
In our next episode.
Absolutely.
But right now, we're going to turn to our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News, my favorite segment.
We're coming up on obituaries, of course. my life-affirming, always my life-affirming beginning to the This Week in Historical News. Olympia Dukakis has died.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, she was from Lowell, and I believe the same area of Lowell that the family that started the Market Basket chain.
Oh.
I think they're all from that area in Lowell, which is a Greek-Irish sort of neighborhood. Other groups were there too, other ethnic groups. She passed away. She was 89. Of course, she was an Academy Award winner and the cousin of presidential candidate and former Massachusetts governor, Michael Dukakis.
With whom I had dinner once.
How was that? Good?
The dinner was okay. He seemed like a real nice guy, actually.
Yeah, I've heard he's a very nice guy. Yeah. Lynn McDonald has died. She was a historian of World War I, a British historian. She was British. she was one of these people who began talking to people, everyday soldiers, about everyday experience in battle and in life in the military. I've read stuff by her, thought she was very good. I think she influenced a lot of people, very sort of straightforward, but did interesting work. She's passed away, as has Michael Collins, the person who, the astronaut. He passed away. Okay. Michael Collins, not the Irish Revolutionary.
That's right. He's probably long passed away.
He's long passed away. No, Michael Collins, the fellow who orbited the moon while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin went down to the surface. And he was rightly has been celebrated recently as being, you know, someone who was really selfless and wanted.
Oh, my gosh.
Wanted to, you know, orbiting the moon by yourself for a couple days.
Yes, that's not the job I would want. I would much prefer to have been Armstrong or Aldrin. He had a much harder job, I think.
I agree. And then you had to make the perfect rendezvous. And, you know, finally, Felix Silla has died. And several of you may be asking, who's that?
Yes,
Felix Silla is the actor who played Cousin It in the Addams Family. I love Cousin It. He passed away, this fella. He was an older guy. I loved Cousin It. I thought that was such a fabulous innovation in a way.
Was he typecast as an It?
Right. Where do you take that role?
Nowhere to go.
There's been a number of pieces in the press. This is a piece from the New York Times on the 5th of May, from the 5th of May from the website. France battles over whether to cancel or celebrate Napoleon. We're coming up on the anniversary of Napoleon's death. And there are people in France saying, well, let's not remember that or commemorate that or mark that or talk about it because Napoleon was bad. He tried to reinstate, you know, reconquer Haiti and restore slavery in the French islands, which the efforts to reconquer Haiti failed, both because of their resistance and disease, you know, impacted his army. The Haitian people resisted him. But French people, there's no understanding you without Napoleon. You have to talk about Napoleon. You cannot pretend like Napoleon didn't.
Maybe the most impactful European of the last 1,000 years.
Right.
Bless you.
Sorry. But I mean, the idea that you can cancel that shows you the depth of the problems people are having intellectually in saying, well, look, okay, Napoleon did some things that are so important that we have to talk about him. You cannot ignore Napoleon.
Yeah. I believe the Napoleonic Code is still the basis for much of the law in Europe. So, you know, you're going to have a problem canceling him.
Right. We're up now. Yeah, you're going to have a huge problem canceling Napoleon. If you want to talk about France, you're going to talk about Napoleon. I mean,
Oh, you are.
Wow. Not only is the legal code still in place, but you also have the Napoleon pastry. I mean, how are you going to do? What are you going to do? Cancel that too? Rename it.
Exactly.
As the Macron?
which will be confused with macaroons.
Right.
And macaron.
We were on the 100th anniversary of the Division of Ireland, which, of course, plays into our series. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to do the series. I do think that it really is, you know, people are commemorating it, but it's very low key. There was a piece in the Boston Globe, which I have to say, and I hope somebody who works for the Boston Globe is listening, I found quite offensive. They didn't do much on it, even though 50% of the population in the greater Boston area, not of Boston, but the greater Boston area, is in part or whole of Irish descent, Irish Catholic descent. And probably if you included Irish Protestants, that number would go higher still. They didn't assign their own reporter to it. They took a piece from the Associated Press.
Wow.
The piece from the Associated Press describes the origins of the Division of Ireland between Unionists and Nationalists. It doesn't mention that one group is predominantly Protestant and the other is predominantly Catholic. It is so inappropriate, this piece, and I hope the people in the Boston Globe are listening. That piece is inappropriate.
You know they listen because they have to figure out what the next big news story is internationally.
Right.
So they know what to write about.
What else is going on in Northern Ireland, though, is sort of more serious. The DUP, the party founded by Ian Paisley, not founded just by him, but the party that he led, their leadership is now contested for the first time since it was founded. In other words, people are arguing over which direction to take it. Some people are saying we've got to try to resist this change because of Brexit, putting the boundary in the Irish Sea. Others are saying we have to do so peacefully and, you know, try to make an accommodation, work through the system. But I think that that's the origins of that conflict. I would say also at the same time that while all this has been going on, the leaders of Sinn Féin, the Irish Nationalist Party that was the political wing of the provost, the Provisional IRA, their leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, has apologized for the killing of Lord Mountbatten and said, look, that was inappropriate. Even though we did it, it was an authorized operation. But in retrospect, that should never have happened. He was a retired old man and innocent people were killed. So what's going on is that Sinn Féin is positioning itself as the party of reconciliation, peaceful progress, following the rules, and the Protestant Unionist parties are positioning themselves as not wanting to follow the Good Friday Agreement, resisting Brexit, fighting over everything, rioting. They're becoming, they're isolating themselves politically in the new political environment. Yep. But she apologized, and this is from the Boston Globe, April 19th. Again, another piece not written by a Boston Globe reporter. They took it out of the New York Times. And they basically said, we were in error in killing him. It was not appropriate.
Well, Brennan, are you implying that there is a way in which the Sinn Féin position is calculated to position them as the reasonable force against the unreasonable unionists?
I think that their position, they're sincere in these apologies, but I also think there's a good bit of political calculation in it. I think the
both
apologies
things can
are
be
sincere.
True.
Both things can be true. I think that they regret how they can look back now, even though they still feel aggrieved by the division of Ireland. They can look back and say, holy cow, that got out of control. We were doing, you know, we were doing things and they were doing things no one should have been doing. Right. And innocent people were being hurt and killed.
Right.
So they're looking back. That said, is that a smart thing to do politically in the present environment? Yes, it is. I did want to point to this demographic situation. U.S. birth rate falls to lowest point in more than a century. The birth rate, the birth rate in China has dipped below 10 million. It is below replacement level. And Japan is becoming a model for basket case demographics.
Yep.
In the last week, there's been more stories. As you know, I've been talking about this for the last 11 years.
Yep.
But it's becoming more and more. But the real issue is, in all of these stories, the writers of the stories cannot bring themselves to probe deeper as to why people do not want to replicate the culture.
Right.
The actual problem.
They keep talking about an aging population, but that's a stupid thing to say. It's not an aging population. It's that there are no babies. That's why it's aging. What is
right? Right. Now, we're going to talk about, and I'm just going to say in passing, we're going to do an episode at some point soon about what's going on in the Academy, the 1619 Project, all the different issues that have arisen. Yeah. I don't want to go into it now because there's too much there. Yeah. There's two other important things I do need to talk about, though, and then we're going to finish with the master. We've got about 2 minutes. This piece from the BBC News on May 4th. Belgian farmer accidentally moves French border. There was a border stone marking the border on his property, and it was getting in the way of his plow, so he invaded France. He moved the stone like 8 yards, and then I guess somebody discovered he had done this, and now people are he's upset. And some Belgians are saying he should be celebrated. He's made Belgium bigger. And now, there is a statue was seized in the port of Los Angeles. An ancient statue that was being imported. As you know, there's a huge problem in the trade of antiquities.
Yeah.
The purported purchaser of this statue, Kim Kardashian.
I knew she was trading in stolen antiquities.
Is it not illicit. Bad enough you're divorcing Kanye? You must steal antiquities as well. Finally, I do not want to close out without mentioning the contribution to the rewilding debate of the guide of the historians, Robin Lane Fox, Meadows with Metal, the title of the piece from April 24th. Overeager farmers and local councils have done much to deplete wildflowers, but a Prince of Wales initiative is fostering their growth. Steps in as a champion of a kind of limited rewilding of the British countryside in a kind of tasteful way that also celebrates the royal contribution at the time when Prince Philip had died. Mm-hmm. Seriously, he steps in and he says, we have to have these British wildflowers. This is another Robin Lane Fox masterpiece. I also wanted to mention that Robin Lane Fox's new book on the use of ancient herbs and plants for medical reasons is out. It's now being reviewed in some of the British press. I urge you to look into the Robin Lane Fox publications. He is a friend of the historians. We are coming up on the end of the show. We're going to continue with our series on archaic Greece. We'll be back soon. We're the historians. Thank you.